In honor of this Thanksgiving week, we are re-airing an interview with a longtime listener and guest named Mitzi Perdue, where she discusses strategies that pull families together and ways to prevent money from pulling families apart. Mitzi is the author of numerous books and over 1,000 articles on a wide range of subjects, from everything from biotechnology to creating and sustaining successful family businesses. She is also the daughter of the business titan who founded the Sheraton Hotel chain and is the widow of the poultry magnate Frank Perdue. So tune in as she discusses family glue and the art of keeping families together during this Thanksgiving week.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava.
The greatest source of wealth in the U.S. has been privately held businesses. Businesses that are starting and creating most of the jobs in the United States. But here's a sad fact. Even with the great fortunes, they never make it down to the third generation. And that's what we're going to talk about today. If you do have a family business, how to make your family business last, with my author today, Mitzi Perdue, her new book, How to Make Your Family Business Last, Techniques, Advice, Checklists, and Resources for Keeping the Family Business in the Family. Mitzi, I want to begin with something you talk about in your opening chapter. The best investment family businesses can make is cultivating a loving, high-functioning family. Let's talk about that, because when you think of success, you sometimes don't think of the personal side of that.
Well, in the Perdue family, we have a saying that I'm fond of, and I think it applies to everybody who's a business family. Happy family, happy business. Miserable family, miserable business. So it's totally worth all the effort that you can put to make it work out. But that immediately raises the question, what do you do to make yourselves high functioning? And I've spent the last probably, I don't know, decade and a half studying that. And you will be happy to know I have an answer.
That's what we're going to talk about in your book. You know, the other thing, and I wonder if you could share this story with our listeners. I think it was during Christmas, you were out shopping with one of your friends. And I wonder if you might tell the story of Carla to sort of get us started, why it's important to have a good family loving relationship.
All right. The story of Carla, I'm disguising her name to protect the guilty, but the amounts of money that I'm going to be talking about are absolutely, totally real. And it happened, golly, just about a year ago, longer than that, but this time of year, about maybe a decade ago. And we were walking down Madison Avenue in New York. And for those who aren't familiar with Madison Avenue, right around the holiday season, it's just one of the most beautiful places possible. Holiday decorations, people carrying their packages, and it's just a happy time. And we were walking along Madison Avenue, and I got to talking about how I was looking forward the next day to go back to Salisbury, Maryland, where my family is, and, you know, just kind of imagining how neat it would be to have the biscuits and the turkeys and everything for Thanksgiving. But then I look over at Carla, and her face is looking drawn, and her, you know, the body language, if you're happy, your emotions are sort of smooth and fluid. And now she was kind of stiff in her walk. And I realized that in some way I had triggered her. And I said, Carla, what's wrong? And she looked over at me and she said, I wish I had a family to go home to. Well, but I said, Carla, you've got your brother Joe. Can't you spend Thanksgiving with him? And she said, no. About 10 years ago, we had a quarrel over our inheritance. Our father left each of us $1 billion. And that's with a B, not an M, $1 billion. And I asked her, well, what went wrong? And she said, we quarreled over, you know, the division of it. There was $2 billion at stake. And he wanted somewhat more than what he was getting already. And we ended up in court. And he lied about me in court. And she told me, when it gets to the point where somebody prefers, when a relative prefers money to the relationship, that's a bridge too far. We could never put it back together again. We haven't spoken except in court for 10 years. And she said, yeah, when she thinks of me going home to a happy family, she told me she would give every penny of her inheritance if she had a family to go home to. And the conclusion that I draw from that, and I bet everybody else draws the same conclusion, that, good Lord, relationships are more important than money, and you've got to do everything you can to support and nurture them, because, good Lord, if it's fallen apart the way it was in the case of Carla, she would have spent $1 billion to have what many of us just take for granted.
Mm, so sad. You know, Mitzi, in your book, let's talk about what does a high-functioning family look like? If you have the ideal family business and the family is getting along, what does that look like to you?
I'm going to quote one of my favorite authors. Her name is Robin Thivish, and she's from Emory University, and she studies high-functioning families. And for her, high-functioning families, and certainly for me, I mean, I agree with this, but I want to give credit to the person where it comes from. A high-functioning family, first of all, they love and support each other, and they're happy to be together. But on top of that, a really high-functioning family, the kids, they're not as vulnerable to substance abuse as most families. They tend to do well in school. They aren't truant. They work on their grades. They don't get in trouble with the law. They don't get the girls don't get pregnant until they're adults and ready for motherhood. They're able to hold down good jobs when they graduate. And very often they go on to higher education. So a high-functioning family has a number of factors to it. And Robin has studied in her laboratory at Emory University, she studied what the factors are that help make a family high-functioning. And it all boils down to they know their family stories. They have a strong, firm culture where they know where they came from and they know what they're about. And they're looking to the future and the past. And it helps them live better in the present if they know their past and they can think towards the future.
You know, that story really hits me. Last year, one of the big movies that came out, which was about John Paul Getty, All the Money in the World, and all the dysfunctions that happened in his own family, a suicide of a son, another one dying of drug overdose. And so you see these kind of tragedies develop from great, great fortunes.
I think it's preventable because my family of origin, the Henderson Estate Company, we began as a family business in 1840. We've been having family reunions since 1890. And the Purdue family, we've been in business since 1920. So both these families, to my mind, are high-functioning, long-lasting. But we don't leave the culture to accident. We're extremely intentional about teaching kids values.
Well, speaking of teaching kids values, let's move on to your chapter on tradition, the lifeblood of identity and the role that plays with family.
This is a particularly good time to talk about it because with Thanksgiving coming up, traditions really are the lifeblood of identity. I mean, it really helps to know who you are and where you came from. People go through life looking for meaning in life, and one of the best sources of it is your family, especially if it's a family business. And in both the Hendersons and the Purdues, we put so much effort into tradition because it's tradition also that helps you transmits the values that you have. Like one of the values that the Purdues have, it's being frugal. Frank Purdue, I mean, he was among the Fortune, I guess it's, no, the Forbes 400. So he's economically a very, very successful man. But one of the things that he did that the family is proud of and emulates, and I still do it today, even though he's been gone 13 years, he would always use public transportation. In any city in the world that we were, whether it was Tokyo or Paris or Moscow, we used the subways. I still use the subways. I still use buses. Another tradition, I'll share with you how we pass down some of the traditions. Like one of them is that in both families, that we're frugal, that unlike John Paul Getty and All the Money in the World, we're kind of low profile. And one of the ways that we have of, like, I don't know, teaching a tradition is we have newsletters in both families. In a recent one for the Purdue family, and the emphasis of it was, you know, the tradition that we are a frugal family. We aren't ostentatious. there's a newsletter for children, roughly six times a year, and each newsletter has within it some kind of tradition or value that we really care about. And a recent one, with Thanksgiving coming up, this is appropriate, great-grandmother Mummy Doo Perdue, she always used to make the most wonderful biscuits for Thanksgiving, and everybody loved them and looked forward to them. But when she made those biscuits, she'd make up the batter, she'd take a baking sheet, she'd cover it with aluminum foil, and then she'd drop the biscuits on the aluminum foil, bake the biscuits, remove them, and then here's the part that's important. She used to wash off the aluminum foil, soap and water, dry it, and reuse it. And the point of that story is that she was frugal. She was ecological. She didn't waste. And to really embed that story in the kids so that it's with them for life, with every newsletter, I include what I call a treasure chest. And inside the treasure chest is an activity. And for that particular one about being frugal, the kids would get the ingredients for Mummy Doo's biscuits and a sheet of aluminum foil, and then a chef's hat and a chef's apron. And for an hour, they would be making biscuits the way Mummy Doo did. And at the end, they themselves would wash off the aluminum foil so it could be reused. And at the end of that, those kids really know that we're a family that is frugal and that we don't waste and that we recycle.
You know, Missy, that reminds me of a couple stories. One, everybody remembers Sam Walton when he was alive driving in his pickup truck in town. And the other one, there was a recent documentary on Warren Buffett being Warren Buffett. He lives in the same house that he's been living in for the last 30, 40 years. And each morning he drives his Cadillac, which is, what, 4 or 5 years old. And his wife puts the exact amount of change in his console so that on the way to work, he goes to McDonald's and whatever she put in his console is what he has for breakfast. And here he's one of the richest men in the world.
I've noticed, you know, and both my father, he was the co-founder of the Sheraton Hotel chain, and Frank Perdue, you know, they were both, trust me, they were wealthy men, but they didn't feel the need to spend money on status or ostentation. Like Frank's house, one of my favorite stories about him is we lived in a ranch house in an area that where one neighbor was a retired teacher and another one had a small feed mill. It was not Millionaire's Row. So he lived in we lived in a very middle class area. And once one of the chicken buyers was driving up to the place with one of the salesmen, and the chicken buyer, as he drove up to the house where Frank and I lived, he was saying, "Oh golly, you're not gonna convince me that Frank Perdue lives there. You're kidding me, right?" And the salesperson said, "No, Frank Perdue really does live there." And the guy said, "You're not gonna convince me of that." Well, at that point they had driven up to the front door and Frank opens the door to greet them, and the guy dumbfounded, "Oh my gosh, he really does live there." So yeah, he didn't have to live in an expensive place. He did drive a Mercedes, but for him that was almost economical because he kept it for 20 years. So he repaired it and babied it. So it was, in the end, if you amortize the value of that car over its use, it was an inexpensive car.
So I'd like to combine these two thoughts. You talk about money and happiness, and money doesn't buy happiness. And then also thinking of philanthropy. So when you think of some of the great fortunes that we know of today, the Rockefellers, Carnegie, even to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Buffett Foundation, they think philanthropically. Let's talk about that and happiness. So it's not all about money.
Well, Frank used to have a saying. In fact, he included it in his ethical will, which is a document that he left to his children and those who came after. And the goal of it was to have them be happy. He had 10 points, and one of them was, and I can't emphasize this enough because I just think it's one of the most true things in the world, if you want to be happy, think what you can do for somebody else. On the other hand, if you want to be absolutely miserable, think what's owed to you. Well, to me, philanthropy is just a way, really, in the end, to be happy. Because, you know, if Frank is right that the way to be happy is to think what you can do for somebody else, philanthropy is a structured way of doing that. And people sometimes ask me, what is it that kept the Hendersons together since 1840? And what's kept the Perdues together? There's several things, but I would put right up at the top philanthropy. Because if you're being philanthropic, you're thinking, to me, it's an antidote to selfishness. To me, it's selfishness that destroys families. But if your image is that you're being a benefit to the community, that you're helping people, that's a true, true, true antidote to selfishness. So I recommend philanthropy to every family that exists. And one of the ways that we're engaged in philanthropy, there is, both families have foundations, but on top of that, like take the case of the Perdues, instead of exchanging Christmas presents with the extended family, at Thanksgiving, very typically, we'll get together and contribute money towards gifts for Perdue Associates, which is Perdue Speak for Employees. There are 22,000 of them, and just, you know, by the law of averages, some people are going to have had fires or floods or one thing or another, where we can help them with gift packages, which, you know, there's 70 or so of us getting together and we're packing them. And even the youngest kids, you know, they'll make drawings of like holiday trees or whatever that will go in the packages. And it's just such a good feeling to know that you're doing something for somebody else. I think Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and everybody else, the Rockefellers in particular, all of them, they're onto something that's just of incredible importance. The less selfish you are, the more high-functioning you're going to be.
Let's talk about carrying this tradition on. You talk about knowing your family's stories. You know, especially this is so important when you look at some of the great fortunes in the country, knowing about grandfather who created the business, stories about it. And you talk about creating a family book, sort of the meaning of what it means to be us.
Both the Hendersons and the Perdues do this. And, you know, even if you're just starting your family, this is worthwhile. It's so easy to take your family for granted. You never, you know, pull back and stop and think, what does it mean to be us? Well, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I started thinking, what does it mean to be us? What does it mean to be us? And I felt that I couldn't answer it myself. So I began, you know, with our newsletters asking, I started with the Hendersons and asked family members, what does it mean to be us? And they would write back like 250 words or sometimes even 1,000 words. And I didn't expect the project to grow as big as it did, but it tapped into something really important, which is people thinking about what does it mean to be members of this family? And what happened was people would write back like a little essay on what it means to be us. And I'd send their essays to the rest of the family, and that would spark interest in other people writing little essays. And pretty soon we had something like 70 essays on what it means to be us. And the advantage of this is just enormous, because it means that like the 80-year-olds can read what the 12-year-olds are thinking, and the 12-year-olds know what the 80-year-olds are thinking. It's just a fabulous way of focusing on the value of being a member of this family. And everybody gets to know each other a little better too, because, you know, you see each other at reunions or stockholder meetings or whatever, but this is kind of more personal. And I found it deeply moving, and the feedback I got from everybody else, because everybody participated, was that it was a tremendous factor for what we call family glue. I wonder how many other families think of family glue, whether a business family or not. There are things that pull you together. I call that family gravity or family glue. And then there's the centrifugal force that pulls families apart. And I want everybody, to the extent that it's possible, to focus on things that are gluey, things that bring you together. Because, honest, can you think of a greater source of either happiness and joy or misery and despair than your intimate relationships? I mean, that's where your heart is. I mean, again, take the case of Carla. She had $1 billion. She'd give every penny of it away if she had a family, a loving, supportive family to go home to. And so, yeah, this kind of effort, the things I'm talking about, they do take effort, but good Lord, they're worth it.
Yeah, I want to move on to something that you talk about, an education committee for the family. For example, learning people skills, etiquette, knowing the basics of the family business, the history, core values, things like teamwork, trust, and also investing, because a lot of these families made their fortune in the family business, but that business has thrown off so much cash that they also have major investment portfolios.
Aha. Well, if I could wave a magic wand and wish something beneficial for my fellow mankind, I would have them copy something that my father did. By the way, you would have adored my father because I listened to you and I know that he would have agreed with everything you say. But back to your question, my father, at the time of his death, there were more than 400 Sheraton hotels. So he was a busy man. He was a captain of industry. But even so, and this is what I wish for our listeners, he had regularly an hour. It was called family hour. After church services on Sundays, he would regularly schedule an hour with whatever siblings of me and whatever siblings of mine were at home, in which he'd talk with us about things like investing, stocks and bonds. What was the difference between a stock? Or how did the free market work? And he was a big believer in capitalism because he felt that it was just the best way that mankind has ever known for raising people's incomes, letting them have better lives, more freedom. He wanted us to know these things, but he deliberately spent the time teaching us. And those family hours that I'm talking about, they weren't always on finance and investment, although a big part of them were, because he felt that he wanted us to have a solid grounding because we were going to inherit, how about lots, and he didn't want us to be dumb about it. And to his enormous credit, I look at my siblings, and nobody was stupid about the wealth that they inherited. They invested it. They didn't go off and buy racehorses and yachts or private planes. They invested it, and they regarded themselves, as Father has taught us, to be stewards for the next generation or for generations to come. But the biggest lesson that I take out of all of that, that he was intentional about it. He didn't leave it to accident. I mean, he told us, we knew how he felt about prenups. We knew how he felt about spending that. One of the lessons that I remember from just the youngest age was, it's okay to spend the income, but don't spend the principal. And actually, he wasn't all that keen on us spending the principal, the income either, because he wanted us to lead at least somewhat normal lives. Which, by the way, coming from a hotel heiress, I think it could have been very easy for me to have had a very different life. But I loved it that he did things like, he insisted that all his children at least have a few years in public schools, so that we could have a somewhat more, a less bubble-like existence than say, that John Paul Getty family member.
I want to move on to some particular issues that really face great fortunes, great family businesses. There, many of them are kind of related, and that is legal disputes. You just mentioned your friend Carla, who spent most of her time in court with her brother. Also, gold diggers. You amass a great fortune. People know you're wealthy. People that maybe want to try to take advantage of that. And then also something that I have gone through with several of my wealthier clients, which is substance abuse. I had a client who wanted his son to come in the business. He simply did not want to go. When Dad insisted on it, he joined the Marines and went to Iraq. But Mitzi, when he came back from Iraq, he was on drugs.
That's one of the most heartbreaking things possible.
Yeah, and so, but we worked with the client and we got him into rehab, and then we got him to, believe it or not, he always wanted to cook. And so he went to a school, got his degree, and became a chef, and is happy doing what he wants to do. But so let's talk about some of the particular problems that hit these kind of family businesses or wealth, legal disputes like your friend Carla, gold diggers, and then also substance abuses, which is what we saw in the Getty family.
Okay, shall we start? Which one do you want to start with? I'm eager to get into any of them because I see them all the time. Oh, in fact, let's start with the legal disputes. In my lifetime, I have talked with hundreds and hundreds of family business advisors. And I think in just about every case I know of, that there's almost consensus that by the time you're in a legal dispute or by the time your argument within the family has reached the press, that's almost a bridge too far. I know family business advisors who simply won't take a client who's reached that point because their success rate in putting it back together again is almost zero. I mean, I'm sure there exists some family that's put it back together again, but by the time you've involved lawyers or by the time the press is out there spilling your family secrets, it takes on a life of its own. So my deep, passionate advice to every family is don't go there. Get professional advice before you go to the lawyers, before you go to the press. And in the case of the Hendersons, we were taught just from childhood, probably as thoroughly as you were taught thou shalt not murder, we were taught this family doesn't air its dirty linen in public. We were taught that you can't do that, that it's immoral to either go to the press or involve lawyers, because we were told there at that point there were 20,000 employees and it would be demoralizing to all of them, or it could encourage competitors to pick us off, or it would be bad for the lenders. You know, just in every possible count, we were required to solve our problems within the family, but we were also given some tools to do it. One of the rules was that if you have an issue, bring it up as quickly as possible. Don't, what we called, gunny sack it. Don't carry around your resentments. We also, I don't think it was ever explicit, but we knew that the harder it was to discuss something, the more important it was to discuss it. And then we had another rule, which is, you know, bring it out, express it thoroughly, but then we tended to make big decisions through consensus, like whether to sell Sheraton Hotels or not, which we did. We did sell the company. But the consensus came after a lot of arguing and back and forth and deeply felt feelings. But we followed our lifetime of training of, we solved it within ourselves. We came to a consensus. And by the way, I was on the side that didn't want to sell. But nevertheless, when there was consensus, I went along. One of our rules was, when the decision's made, you can't always be right. You're not always going to get your way. When the decision's made, you close ranks and you move forward and you don't look back. And the Perdue family has almost the same rule. And I'm going to guess that that has something to do with why we've lasted for 98 years, which is, we call it the covenant in the Perdue family. The Hendersons called it, we don't wash our dirty linen in public. The Perdues call it the covenant. But the covenant is, whatever your grievance is, whatever the conflict is, bring it out, air it, make sure you're heard, make sure you're listened to. Then when a decision is made, you move forward, but you do not go, the covenant part is that you don't go outside the family. It's fine to get the advice of a family business counselor. It's fine, anything that's not public, but by the time you go to lawyers or the press, your company and your relationships are probably going to implode.
Gold diggers and maybe prenups, some of them could be related because I know as an advisor dealing with well-to-do individuals, this is something that, it's an issue that we run into, especially in Mitzi's second marriages, where, let's say, the husband was very wealthy, he passes on, wife inherits the wealth, and a lot of times you get gold diggers that come in, know that you have the money, and it happens, and we hear a lot of stories about it.
Well, let me share mine. I consider my, this is so immodest to say this, but deal with it. I think I'm more of an expert on this than average, because I remember when Frank passed away and he was in the Forbes 400, so it made, how about headlines throughout the world? I remember my cousin, Ned Horn, telling me, Mitzi, do you realize that right now there's probably 50 people reading those obituaries or Frank's obituary, and they're right now figuring out how to get to you? And Ned Horn was right, except that he underestimated it. I mean, you just would be astonished at how many people want free money. It was amazing. I'm 77 years old and proud of it. But in those 77 years, since I'm the kind of person who kind of likes to observe and maybe learn from what I see going around me, the number of gold diggers that are out there are just extraordinary in the amount of misery they can cause, not only to the immediate victim of it, but the family as well. It's a catastrophe for a family business when a real dyed-in-the-wool gold digger gets their claws into a widow or widower. I'm totally in favor of anybody with wealth to be as suspicious as possible. And my father used to say that if a con man looked like a con man, he wouldn't be a con man. And that means that some of the gold diggers can be just miraculously clever. They can convince you that they're your soulmate, they're the person you've been waiting for all your life, that everything that you care about and hold dear is the most important thing in the world to them. And my recommendation to everybody is, well, I hope I'm right on this, but it's my recommendation. Most of the cases that I know that turned out really terribly, the person, let's say it's the widow. The widow always had way in the back of her mind some little warning voice that was saying, you know, this is too good to be true. But then they'd talk themselves out of it and say, gosh, I don't want to be judgmental. I don't want to be paranoid. I don't want to, this may be the best thing that's ever happened to me. I don't want to screw it up by being too suspicious. The people, almost every case that I know that ended in misery, at the beginning, during the love bombing stage, where you're the most wonderful thing the guy's ever seen in his life, during the love bombing stage, everyone that I've ever talked with did have some little voice saying, you know, this isn't right, I should be suspicious, and then they talk themselves out of it. So my recommendation is be suspicious as all get out. Get to know their family, get to know their friends, get to know their history. Don't take people at face value.
And Mitzi, just a fabulous, fabulous book. And if you are out there listening, you have a family business, you're building a fortune, you want it to last and go beyond just one generation. As I started this interview, I mentioned most great fortunes don't make it down to the third generation. This may be a book that can help you get there. Mitzi, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. The name of the book is How to Make Your Family Business Last: Techniques, Advice, Checklists, and Resources for Keeping the Family Business in the Family by Mitzi Perdue, who's been my guest. Mitzi, all the best to you. It was a real pleasure speaking with you and reading your book.
It's been sheer joy for me. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That concludes my interview with Mitzi Perdue, and once again, just so many pearls of wisdom. If you're one of the fortunate listeners out there, you've built a nice family business, you're creating great wealth, you've got a family, you want it to last and go beyond, read Mitzi's book. There's a lot of great wisdom in it, because you don't want to get in a situation where, you know, as we started that interview with the one woman that inherited $1 billion but spent 10 years, you know, in court fighting against her brother. That's not what you want to see happen. So once again, How to Make Your Family Business Last by Mitzi Perdue. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.